Welcome to Handbaggage Only. And today, I'm joined by Lord John Bird, founder of The Big Issue, to speak about friendship and homelessness. So thank you so much for joining me today. As I mentioned to you earlier, as a therapist and a researcher, the thing that I always look for when I'm learning about different topics, different issues in the world, I'm always interested in the social dynamics, the social aspects of why people struggle with whatever's going on in their life. And the thing which I find is missing when looking at the issue of homelessness is we speak a lot about housing, we speak a lot about the cost of living crisis, but we don't speak a lot about the social network issues which homeless people might be facing. And how are those being worked on? Are those being worked on? So today, because that's what this podcast, essentially, that's what we're looking at, is friendship. I've invited you on today to speak firstly about your experience of homelessness and how it affected you socially. And then if we can speak a bit more in broader terms about homelessness.
I'm here. I'm your man.
Fantastic. So then maybe we could just jump right in. Can I ask you about your first experience of homelessness?
Well, I don't want to tell off my parents, but they weren't particularly good at paying the rent. And they had a predilection to go to the pub on a Saturday night. So they were a kind of London Irish family. I found out much later that the man I thought was my father was not my father. He was an Irishman who my mother had a relationship with, and she was Irish, so I'm more Irish. I thought I was English as well as Irish, but anyway. So, but they weren't particularly good at paying the rent, so we were always hiding from the rent men. And in the end, when I was five, I came home from school, and all our worldly goods were on the street. So I was homeless at five, and then we slept in a void in the roof of my grandmother's cottage and round the corner for a year. And then we were in a slum flat. We'd moved from the slum ruins of Notting Hill to Bayswater, and we lived in the slum place there, part condemned flat. And then we were only there 6 months and the rent wasn't paid, so we were thrown out. And then I was taken in by the Sisters of Charity, which is, an order of St. Vincent de Paul. So I was brought up for a few years, two or three years there. So homelessness was very early on. And it wasn't very good, because even though we managed to move from the two rooms we had into this void in the roof where we slept, my mother and father slept in the bed, and me and my two brothers slept at the other end. And my brothers were incontinent, so there was a lot of water and other stuff, and the sheets were always being, it was terrible, and we got ill. I got scarlet fever and all that stuff. So, and these were the slums of Notting Hill, so it was not very nice. Rats everywhere and dirt and all that stuff. So it was pretty horrible. But I have to say, they were the happiest times of my life. And I tell you why. Because the whole street we lived in, we were all mates. You know, we might fight and get drunk and all that, but there were all these Irish people and Cockneys. And I always feel I've been in exile, even now. I'm 77 now. I'm talking about when I was up to the age of seven. I feel I was in exile, and it was to do with the community. It was to do with you belonged to old people who'd survived the First World War, who were, you know, going around in black clothes and all sorts of things like that. So it was a place of great friendship.
That's extraordinary, because at the age of 5 to 7, you felt like you belonged. So you already had that experience of community. Did you go to school? Did you have it there as well?
Oh, yeah. That's the other interesting thing, because I had two older brothers who didn't want to go to school, and they used to run away from school. And when it was my turn to go, my mum was astonished that I wanted to go, but I think I had a passion to learn. And it was the best school I ever went to. So for the first 2 years of my schooling, I absolutely loved it. I learned so many things. I could tell the time. In fact, I almost began to learn to read and write. But unfortunately, it all fell to pieces when I was seven. We got kicked out. And then we were taken in by the Sisters of Charity and put in an orphanage for a few years. And that's when my life really went downhill. And I became truculent and troublesome and, you know, and they were always having to discipline me. And it was largely because I missed Notting Hill and my parents. And I didn't see my dad for 2 years.
But did you find a common bond with the other kids?
No, not at all. I was always fighting. I mean, everybody who was nice in the world also was a girl or a woman. So some of the nuns were very nice and some of them weren't. But I didn't get on with... I think it was then I started to be the kind of rather nasty little boy who was always, you know, being a pain in the rear.
So you're being a pain in the rear and you're not getting on with the other kids.
And not getting on with my older brothers, because my older brothers, who were 2 and 3 years older than me, they joined the system. So they worked with the nuns because they were old enough.
So did that annoy you?
I just thought they were traitors. And I didn't like them. I didn't like the fact that they were in with the system.
Okay, so then talk me through what happens next. You're an angry boy. You're living with the nuns. You're in this orphanage. You are isolating yourself from everyone else around you because you miss your old life. Then what? What happens next?
Well, I mean, that went on for a few years. I think it was two and a half years. And then, lo and behold, we got a council flat in Fulham, where Fulham meets Chelsea on the King's Road, the new King's Road, that area. And we're all back with mum and dad. And there was another couple of kids. So there were six boys then. And I thought Fulham was... I was in exile from my uncles and aunts, the Irish ones in Notting Hill. I was in exile, really, from the community of Notting Hill and the Cockney Irish thing. I didn't like Fulham. I didn't like school. I started getting into trouble at school, and I started to fight with teachers and stuff like that, and I got into trouble. And then I got involved in shoplifting and stealing bikes and trying to steal cars. And then I kind of got into lots of terrible little things, started fires.
All on your own?
No, with groups. I mean, it was so interesting that I kind of gathered around me a group of people who weren't very nice. And they were like me. They were just troublesome. And they would do things, you know, they'd walk into somebody's house and do things. I remember I didn't break into this girl's house, but it was somebody's girlfriend, and we climbed in through the window. I remember then that I wasn't like them even, because one of them, there was a bucket on the stairs, and he had a shit in the bucket, you know, where the woman was washing. And I thought this was perverse. So then I kind of drifted away from them. I got arrested for housebreaking, even though, because one of us had stolen some money, not me. So I distanced myself from them because they were just, it was just kind of a little mad posse of trouble people, and I didn't like them anymore. And then I started fighting with them, and then, you know, it was chaos.
When you look at, when you think back now, when you reflect back on those people, you've got that self-awareness now to say, you know, I know why I was like this. It's because I missed Notting Hill. It's because I felt I was living in exile. Do you think, firstly, did you have that self-awareness back then?
I think I realized at a very, very early age that I was brought up by people who were not adult. Mm. I was astonished at how strange and how unworldly they were. So my mother, who was a, you know, would always had a cigarette in her mouth when she got the chance, and wasn't very nice. I mean, she was also a racist, you know, she didn't like black people, didn't like Jews, didn't like Arabs, didn't like Indians. And it was this poison that was all permeating in this world of, you know, underclass life, slum life. I've never, ever been able to imagine a world which was so bad in terms of my relationship with my mother and father. But out about us were people who loved us, you know, old ladies who had lost their children in the war or things like that. So there was this real contradiction. But what I find is that even from an early age, I was thinking, why are they doing this? Why are they spending half of their wages in the pub on a Saturday night? So one of the things I did, which was weird, my mother was a smoker, so on a Friday she would be Saturday, Sunday, and then... So I started taking her cigarettes. So I'd take five or six of her cigarettes and I'd surrender them to her gradually over the week. And because I was in revolt to this kind of stupidity of, you know, a pound burning a hole in your pocket.
Okay, so how do you go from, you've been angry, you've been running with the wrong crowd, you recognize that they're not good for you, and you recognize that also the home that you're living in, the parents that you've got, are not great role models.
No.
Okay, so...
And I think the...
Socially, you've got no one around you who's giving you anything good to hang on to and to help you to aspire to. So how do you make that shift? How does that occur?
Well, that's kind of... I always, you know, a lot of people say to me, who's your role model? I can't think of any. I mean, I can honestly say I was not impressed with the adult world. You'd get on a bus and the bus conductor would get over there. An old lady would get on and would move you from your seat. Get out, you know, and all that. And they were kicking dogs. You know, I mean, animals, kicking animals, punishing animals for being animals. They were hitting children in the street. There was this racism. There was this kind of xenophobia, you know. And I thought there's something wrong with this. And also, they were wasting their lives by smoking and drinking and doing all the things that later on I did. So I think I was a weirdo. I think I just stopped and thought, I looked around and I thought, how I changed, I was blessed that every time I got nicked, they taught me something. So when I was eventually, you know, I was in a detention center, which is like a 3 months of beating young boys up so that they don't get into crime. And it's all ex-soldiers. Get up in the morning, 5:50 in the morning, lights out at 9:30, locked in a cell, you know, an hour and a half exercise before breakfast and all that. And, you know, showers where you go in and, you know, all the boys, they just throw bars of soap at you and, you know, everybody's washing and there's no privacy or anything like that. But I learned things. I learned to be tougher. I learned, I mean, physically stronger.
But was there a sense of community there in those places?
It was interesting because when I went into this institution, all the tough boys were Catholics. So they looked after you. And then the Catholics went and then you were on your own. So, there was camaraderie, you know, I made numbers of friends who became my mates and I saw them afterwards. Unfortunately, whenever we met, we always did something wrong.
Okay.
And, you know, stealing or something like that, nicking cars and all that stuff. But we were mates. But when I left school at 14 because they signed me off the register and said, look, we'll fill in the register, but you don't have to come to school. And that happened when I was 14. And so for the last 6 months of my school life, I wasn't at school. And then I had about 12 jobs in about 3 months. Just boom, boom. The shortest job was 2 hours, and the longest was about a week and a half, you know. And then I got nicked for receiving money under false pretenses because my mate had robbed his grandmother's flat and stole her savings card, and he wanted me to cash it, so I cashed it for him. Then he didn't get into trouble. I got done. Then I went on the run and slept for the next 2 or 3 months, rough sleeping and avoiding the police. And then when they got me, actually the interesting thing, maybe you don't want to hear this, but when I was arrested, I was wearing girls' underwear.
No, you have to tell me.
because a couple of days before I got arrested, I was begging, and these two young girls took me home, young women took me home. This was in Chelsea, and they took me home and they bathed me. And then they threw my underwear away, and they gave me these pink knickers with little bows on. So when I got arrested, the police they had a great time. And it, what was so interesting also, because I was a storyteller, the coppers loved me. So it was a wonderful, you know, these two coppers who were looking out for me, the detectives who'd picked me up had beaten me up because I'd run them ragged because I'd disappeared for 2 or 3 months. But, it was a camaraderie between us and them. So there was a kind of joy almost because they were used to kind of people coming in, you know, and it was me telling stories and all that. But anyway, I then went to this institution, which was called a reformatory. And then I ran away from that, and we stole a car with this other bloke, smashed it up at 87 miles an hour, a little sports car. And then they put me in prison. And in prison, that's when I really worked. I was only there a couple of months. And I learned to read and write almost instantly. I knew dyslexia is one of the things that I think I had. Mm. And dyslexia is where you know the big words, but you don't know the meaning of the sentence. So I stumbled through my education. And when I was in this boys' prison, Ashford Boys' Prison, the screw gave me a book, and he knew that he said, you don't know. And then he said, write down all the words, underline all the words that you don't understand. And there are all these little words like there, when, you know, therefore, and thorough, and not the big words, Constantinople, New York, or whatever. So he explained things and explained the structure of the sentence. It was the first time I could tell anybody I could read something but not understand it. And it was brilliant. So every time I got nicked, I learned something. I went back to this reformatory, and after they'd punished me for a while, they then said, what do you want to do in the evenings? And I said, I want to draw and paint. So I started writing stories, writing poems, crap poems, very bad poems. And I started painting and drawing. And within about a year, I was convinced, because I've got delusions of grandeur as well, I was going to be the world's greatest painter. So I built up this enormous portfolio. And when I came out at the age of 18, I walked down the road to the Chelsea School of Art, and I got in. So I became an art student. I was out of Nick about 6 months, and I was an art student in with all these middle-class people who all had largely grammar school or public school, and I was in this totally different world. It didn't last because I got into trouble. I mean, I met a young lady and got more interested in her than art, and then got into more trouble and then more trouble and then fell back into being chased by the police and not appearing at court and all that. And that went on probably for about 7 years. I hid from 1967 at the age of 21 until I was 27.
So what I find fascinating is I'm listening to you, and what I'm hearing is you grew up in this lovely, what felt like a safe environment. And then as you go in and out of the different experiences that you've had, for as much as you hated the adult world, it seems as if you were most at home with the adult. Well, the adult world is the one which gave you the most grounding as a child through your teenage years, because every time you were with people of your own age, because of the circumstances, you were falling into trouble. And then you're being reprimanded, but you're in a location, you're being put in, you know, a reformatory, or you're in prison. And what you've got are, because of your ability to speak up and to share what's going on for yourself, you've got the police who are listening to you. You've got the guys in prison who are sitting there and going, actually, there's something more to this guy. And what you managed to do is you were able to build relationships with people whereby you're not just a troublemaker, but you're more than that. There's more to you than that. And they gave you opportunity. And because you were willing and you're someone who likes to learn, you took that opportunity, you learned to read, you learned to write, and you started painting, you started expressing yourself. You went off to art college. Okay, you didn't stay there because, okay,
yeah,
you kept falling back in.
I was seriously lacking love. So I met somebody who loved me, and I was off.
Okay.
And then the art went...
Okay.
I mean, when you're 18, you're led by... Well, you know, what's... You know, not your mind, it's something else, isn't it?
Well, also, you're looking for connection. At the end of the day, that's what all of us need. We're social creatures. We need connection. And someone who's had such a history of intermittent connection and nothing long-lasting, I'm not surprised. Who wouldn't? Okay, I get that. Do you think this is very similar to other people who are experiencing homelessness? Is it that lack of connection that keeps people in that state? This is what I'm trying to get my head around. You see, for me, I don't understand. You know, you were 5 years old, your parents didn't pay the rent, but you had a community around you. Where were they? Why? How does it... Is it because they didn't have the capability to help you themselves that you ended up in an attic and then ended up going elsewhere? I don't understand. How does homelessness persist? How does it happen?
Well, you know, people have said to me that what we need to do is build more social housing in order to end homelessness. And I always say, yeah, let's build more social housing, let's build affordable housing, call it what you want. I said, but the point is, I've never met a homeless person whose problem was they didn't have a home. What I found was that they had enormous problems. And it's the early years start, it's the start. It's the fact that there's no proper nurturing. There's no love, there's violence, lots of domestic violence. I mean, I watched my mother being beaten shitless by my father, or the man I thought was my father. I watched that, it was terrible. And when I was in a position to do something about it, when I was 18 and I'd come out, I mean, I gave my dad a kick in and he never touched my mum again, because I stamped on him and I said, you fucking hurt her and I'm going to fucking hurt you. So I pulled, you know, I took the bully's card from him and he never touched her again. There are all these sorts of things, and the children, I mean, I don't believe that anybody in prison, with some rare exceptions, should be in prison. We should be imprisoning society for allowing our children to be vilified and abused. And this is, the parents are not even aware of what they're doing, because all they're doing is passing on. I mean, the man who was beating my mother up, had, you know, he inherited that. You know, it was an inherited poverty, poverty of spirit, poverty of mind, poverty of being, poverty of everything, and physical poverty. So, you know, to me, society it doesn't work because it does not address the reasons why we fill our prisons up with some pretty awful people. I was talking, a friend of mine who, you know, went on and murdered people. And if you looked at what his dad had done to him, if you'd looked at all the viciousness that was, you know, drummed into him, a very intelligent, highly sensitive person was made into an animal. That, you know, I've never seen a baby with a brick in their hand. And therefore, when you meet homeless people, you are always meeting people, 9 times out of 10. They come from the same socioeconomic group. The only inheritance they get is poverty. And they're reckless, feckless, and lost. And I was like that. I was reckless, feckless, and lost. I got out of it because I found my North Star, as they say, which was art and writing. I mean, I've been writing rubbish for years. And if you ever saw some of my poetry, it's absolute crap. But I can honestly say that's how I sensitize and humanize myself.
Okay, interesting words, sensitize and humanize, because I think this is the thing, the conversation I've been having with the team actually, is there is almost this dehumanization of people once they fall into poverty. They become faceless, we just don't see them anymore. And this is the thing, when I was preparing for this conversation with you, I went on the website and I looked at the Big Issue website, and that was, I'm really sorry, I haven't been on the website before, and it was unbelievable how all of a sudden, you know, my Big Issue seller, my local Big Issue seller, all of a sudden, I know more about him because I was able to look at his profile. I was able to look at him and then other places where I've been, recognize the people who I see and who I support. And all of a sudden, there is a humanity which came back. All of a sudden, I started to recognize them as just normal people in the population who have just fallen on hard times. And I agree with you. There is this dehumanization almost once someone falls into poverty. Okay, so how do you deal with that? How do you work with that? Because for me, I'm looking at social policies going on, and for me, there's some grassroots issues which are not being dealt with, and that's community. You know, how do you... Compassion. You said it yourself, you know, people were mean, people were violent. There's no compassion. And then a child who is playing truant at school or acting out at school, and we're excluding them rather than actually sitting down with them and saying, you know, what the hell's going on with you? How are you? How do we change the system? Because the system's so upside down, and I don't know.
Yeah, you see, I think the real... I mean, we have a class system, and nobody wants to talk about class. I was with the Prince of Wales recently, because he's involved in a very big project around trying to end homelessness, and he's going to put lots of resources. And I said to him, you know, and we've got a class system. We've got a system where you have the rich and you have the poor. And it's uncomfortable to say this to one of the richest men in Britain, but I say it. You have a system where the predictability of failure comes out of this class system. And this class system is an under-educated, under-provided, under-supported group of people who do your menial tasks, who drive your lorries or, you know, dig your roads and all that. And there's been this kind of class-based system. And that's why I come from labourers. You know, I come from... you know, farm labourers in Ireland, and I come from, you know, road labourers over here, you know. So, and that class system, they try and hide it. You know, the Labour Party tries to pretend that they're for the middle classes as much as the working class. But, you know, and the Conservatives think that there's nothing wrong with poverty, because, you know, if you're brave and strong, you can get out of it. And they always look at me and say, oh, look at John Bird, he got out of it, and all that. But most people don't fall far from the tree. even Boris Johnson has never fallen far from the tree. Well, you look at it, somebody who comes from poverty, they're not going to fall far. I'm one of those strange people that's leapt from the base of the tree and I'm 10 trees down. But I'm still controlled by that early, you know, the early days of my life and all that stuff. So the thing is, you have to attack the class system. And to attack the class system, you then have to look at those early years. You have to look at why is it that some children will only get a poverty of thinking, a poverty of experience from their parents, because that's all they've got to give them. And often they will give them the means of making themselves immune to suffering. So they'll toughen them up. My dad, or the man I thought was my dad, was always saying, if I came home with a black eye, he'd almost want to give me a black eye. What are you doing getting a black eye? And I'd say, you know, I got attacked. Well, you know, he'd get out there again and beat them all up or whatever. So he was trying to create an armor around me, because that's often the only way that you can survive poverty and the rejections that go with it. But back to the homeless people, virtually all of the homeless people I know, as I said, they're like, homelessness is the tip of the social iceberg. If you look at it, you say, oh, they don't have a home. Well, that's the trajectory that of their lives is almost determined that would be one of the things they wouldn't have. But the other thing, of course, which we fail to really understand, is that we live in a low-wage economy. Britain is one of the lowest-wage economies in the metropolitan world, and it's a low-investment economy. So our investors invest in jobs where cheap jobs, cheap things. You look at all the expansion that you've had on the internet, it's nearly all produced low-wage jobs. Some jobs, some posh jobs, but it's driving a van. It's making a delivery. If you took vans and delivery out of Amazon and all these other people scooting all over the country, what have they got? You know, it's low-wage economy. So they need, in a sense, all they need is people who can find their way on a sat-nav. So there is this kind of built-in classness. You know, you produce people to fail in everything other than the most basic thing, which is to dig a hole in a road or drive a van. And until we challenge that, because that is the... And I'm not speaking as a kind of revolutionary Marxist. I'm speaking as a practical person who has spent 32 years running the big issue and spent many decades before reflecting on homelessness, reflecting on poverty, and concluding that until we, in a sense, turn the world a bit upside down and invest in the poorest amongst us. The other irony is, this is the biggest irony. When I was 16, I was in an institution that cost three times what it cost if they'd put me into Eton. Eton was about £23 a week, and where I was about 65. So the thing is, the poorest amongst us often cost much, much more. So it is even bad capitalism. It's bad arithmetic. 40% of all the money that the government gets goes into maintaining people in poverty.
I agree with you. The system needs a huge change. But the thing which I keep banging my drum at is, and you've said it yourself, you're not going to get change if you don't help. And you can go in at any level, the grandparents, the parents, the kids. But there is that inherited trait, as you said, the anger, the whatever you want to call it, the issues that are there, which each generation is passing on to the next generation. At some point, you need a pattern interrupt, something which is going to stop it so that we can help. For me, the way you change this is by changing the way the whole community works. If you've got a community who believe that they will never have and they will never attain, they're never going to get, because they're not going to know how to do it. And it's, how do you change that? As I said, you know, for me, I've had a couple of experiences with homelessness, not me personally, just people around me. And one, this kid who chose to sleep rough. Another one, a family who lost their home and were struggling to speak to the other family members to get the help that they needed. And luckily, there were other friends around who were able to support them. But there are social issues there. There's whatever it is, whether it's anger, pride, a feeling of I'm not worth, of lack of worth, self-worth, I'm never going to achieve it, I can't do it. All of these seem to be inbred in the lower classes, as you would say. How do you deal with that? Surely that needs to be changed as well.
Yeah.
It's, you know.
But it's not going to, you see, the problem is that the reason government is important in this, and this is why I went into the House of Lords. I went in to dismantle poverty. I didn't go in to make the poor more comfortable. And it's, you see, the way the government spends its money is it often spends its money in the emergency. So they're always dealing with the problem.
Yeah, they're reactive rather than preventative.
So Johnny Bird, or Tony Bird as I was then, he's a naughty boy, so we grab him, we take him off the street, and we put him in a place, and we spend a fortune on him. And then 2 years later, we let him out. And he goes back to the humdrum. No one's done anything with his psychology or his mentality. And he gets into trouble again. So, and then they grab him and they spend more money on him. And that is what they're doing. It's the same as the NHS. The NHS is not a national health service, it's a national sick service. And that is, unfortunately, the thinking. The problem is that thinking costs too much money and is not, therefore, useful. So that it's not preventative. They don't prevent the problem. 80% of all social intervention money in the world is spent on emergency and coping. Very little on prevention and nothing on cure, worth talking about. So you actually, you need to change the psychology of thinking around government. And unfortunately, the people who get the job of government are politicians. And politicians themselves are quite ordinary people. You know, they're either, you know, estate agents or you know, they work in PR or something like that. You know, the House of Commons is full of people whose trade, you would find it difficult to describe how they made their money. And it's, you know, people like Boris Johnson, so full of themselves and so kind of, you know, uppity, you know, and he's only there because his dad spent a fortune on putting him into the posh school so he could then go to the posh university, so he could then pick all his posh mates who were there for him, his friendship, you know, build his network. And until we get people who have different life experiences, I mean, I'm thoroughly disappointed in the quality of what you might call, in some ways, middle-class life. It took me a while to get into the middle classes. And when I got in, I thought, Jesus, they're as thick as two short planks. You know, I mean, geez, I mean, you know, they're dinner parties. I mean, why? I mean, most people seem to go to university so that they can hold good dinner parties at a later stage. And you can get a job out of that. You know, some of the, anyway, so I don't want to go on. I don't want to sound classes. But I, like, as a child, I noticed the adults were not very adult. Now I'm an old git and I'm in the House of Lords. I don't think governments are very adult. I don't think they're very businesslike. And I want to invest in the well-being of people. And if you're going to invest in the well-being of people, you've got to stop spending the money that we spend at the point when the crisis is Let's do it pre-crisis. Let's prevent the crisis.
And it's interesting because I had a conversation with Specsavers, who I know are working with the big issue.
Yeah.
And one of the most fascinating things I found... So I was doing some research for something that I'm working on in my own... I'm doing a PhD at the moment.
Tell us.
Well-being and chronic illness. And what I found was... There was this fascinating paper, which a study that showed that you access better healthcare if you go to your doctor with a friend or a family member. And as I said, I was preparing for this conversation with you, and it made me think. I'm like, okay, how many homeless people have a friend or a family member who they can go to a doctor with? Or, you know, does that mean they're accessing worse healthcare or not getting as good treatments because they don't have someone to advocate for them? And I was discussing this with this lady at Specsavers, and she said, well, yeah, that's why we're working with a big issue, because there's a lot of homeless people who can't even access the NHS because they're homeless. And what we found is, you know, there's a lot of people, homeless people, who they're vision impaired or they've got wax buildup and they can't hear. And, you know, that's just the basic human connection is being able to see each other, being able to read facial expressions, being able to listen to each other. You know, how do you enter society? How do you build those incredibly important social networks if you can't even do that? And so she was telling me about how, you know, Specsavers are doing that with big issue sellers, and they're hoping to work with more people who are homeless, which I found fascinating. But it's that. It's how do we get more of that? How do we get more of those social actions to help people to connect better? So on a purely basic level of being able to see and hear, but then to be able to speak more openly, to be able to be kinder to each other. And yes, government will have a role, but do we always have to lay it at the feet of government? What about just the general society, the general public?
Yeah. Well, yes. I agree with what you're saying. But the reason you've got to bring the government in is because the government is maintaining a lot of people in poverty, not getting them out of poverty or even preventing them. So we need that. But it can't be done by government alone. And I agree with you. And things like Specsavers are a great sign of the fact there's an appetite in society. Mm. To bring about social change. We work with a lot of businesses, and if you speak to the staff, you'd almost think that they weren't there for profit. They want social profit. They want the profit of helping people, because it's what gets them out of bed in the morning. They work for a company that helps people in the course of making profits. But overall, what we need, I mean, like for instance, if you take police officers away from the community, which is a government decision, you impoverish the community. They've had these experiments, I think in Wales or in Scotland, where they've returned police officers, and it reduces the amount of vandalism and all sorts of things, which makes it a happier community. We had a conference in 2017, I think, and it was called the Social Echo Conference. And it was looking on the well-being of a community. So we went to Northampton, and we got a number of partners there, people like Carlsberg, the biggest employer in town, Nationwide, another big employer, lots of small little organisations, sandwich bars, we got the university. And we said, what we're going to do is help you have a healthier community, a better community, a community of well-being. And we're going to start with the simple thing of money. So we started with money. So what we did was we introduced the housing association to the estate agents. What would you do that for? They could be nice to each other and share sandwiches, or what about doing something practical? So the housing association, 70% of their tenants are unemployed, out of work. And they want to grow, they want to do more and more business. They have to buy big rotavators and big things to cut the grass and all that, and they have to paint doors. And so they're a kind of little building. and a maintenance business. The estate agent has 150 buy-to-lets, and they get £100 a month or whatever to look after these buy-to-lets. So they have an appetite for the services. So we put them together. And that creates a niceness. It creates a kindness, because you've got two people who want something from each other. The problem with a lot of voluntarism is you've got one lot of people who want to do something for another lot of people. And I always say, if you've suffered some kind of tragedy, go out and help somebody. You know why? Because you become equal. You've got the person with the problem, and you yourself hold a problem. And the problem you hold is the tragedy of your loss or whatever, or the fact that your husband or girlfriend or whatever has run off with somebody else. So you've got an equality. So you both need each other. That is the most wonderful way, in my opinion, of creating well-being. We got the local hospital buying bread from a baker's, and the baker's was run by a woman who'd suffered domestic violence. And she, virtually all of the people working there were people who'd suffered from domestic violence. So 9,000 loaves a month were bought from this baker's rather than buying them from an estate, you know, an industrial estate in the north of England. So what you do is you bring, it's the well-beingness, it's the kindness, it's the niceness. And unfortunately for us, it only worked for a while, because a lot of this is based on personality. If the personality changes, the guy you're working with at the university leaves. So now we've got a problem, because we want to go back and do this. And we have to say, how do we get beyond ego? Because it's the ego. I'm going to drive this. We need a lot of Johnny Birds. But we don't need Johnny Birds. We need the people who are going to do it when Johnny Bird's gone off and done something else.
No, but it is. It's finding those people who are willing to be friends to the cause, almost, yeah. Where they're doing it because it's just a nice thing to do. It's the compassionate. But you also get something from it yourself. You know, we know just our neurobiology. Every time we do something good, we get a kick of dopamine. We feel good about ourselves, and that actually makes us want to do more good in the world. So everyone wins. So it's for me, as I said. I always struggle when it comes to homelessness. I always struggle with this because I don't understand how you get the way out without, you need government, absolutely, but you also need society. You need society.
Yeah, but can I divide it between two things?
Yeah.
One is that you have to provide an enormously supportive system for people in the sticky stuff now, and that's what you're talking about.
Yeah.
And what I'm saying is, I went into Parliament to prevent people needing to have that support. So you've got to do the two things at the same time. The big issue has grown up in the emergency. So it's about the emergency and the coping, helping people, and hopefully some of them will get to cure. But until we start trying to turn the tap off, which is why I'm in Parliament. But I know damn well I can't, if I meet, I was with a homeless guy on Monday who's an artist as well as a number of other things, who can write and all sorts of stuff. You know what he lacks? He lacks family, he lacks love, he lacks friendship.
Yeah.
And we give him that. In some weird sort of way, I'm his dad. I'm his elder brother. I'm whatever. I'm the person there for him who, because it has not been provided by, you know, the people who he grew up with. And that is one of the major things that we have to address with the people in the crisis. We cannot ignore the problem as it is. But at the same time, we have to create the intellectual energy to turn the tap off.
So the thing that you have said repeatedly, which I think is probably the thing as me as a social psychologist is picking up on the most is that the people who are homeless very often have been deprived of love. They've been deprived of care. And as I said, this is a podcast which is essentially about friendship. And if you don't get that from your family, then you look for it in your friends. And if you're not getting that from your community and your friendship groups, then you're going to struggle. If there was something that my audience could take from this, what would you want it to be? If there was something that, you know, the average person on the streets who doesn't really, you know, at the most, they come out off the tube, they see someone who's homeless or a big issue seller, they don't know what they can do to help. What would you say? What would you do?
Well, that I often get accused, maybe not accused, but praised, especially in the early days of the big issue. We took some very rough Rabelaisian type people, and we seem to calm them down and make them a part of the community. Mm. And often people say, John, how the hell do you get them so well behaved, so honest, or so straightforward, you know, so accommodating, so thoughtful? You know, they'll wish you a good day even if you don't buy the magazine. And they think, and I say, it's nothing to do with me. I said, it's you. I said, what do you mean? I said, well, I'm blessed because I've got, you know, 10,000 amateur psychologists every day going and talking to the big issue vendors and recognizing their humanity by talking to them. I used to be a beggar, and most of the people we started off when we started the big issue, they were beggars. And what's interesting about a beggar is the first thing a beggar will do is exaggerate their circumstances. Now, their circumstances are often terrible, but they'll make it even worse. What they'll do is they'll, you know, I mean, when I was walking around as a 12-year-old begging along the King's Road, Chelsea, my mum died every day and was reborn at night, and then she died the next day, or was in an iron lung or something, or my dad had fallen off the roof and was likely to die within a few days. And so you know, so you never get close to beggars because they've always got the brand, which is themselves. They're like a little mini brand, and they're selling that. Now, what we try and hopefully do in the big issue is people will talk to a vendor and they will get some spirit of humanity. Mm. Because they feel, oh, I'm talking to this guy, he's an equal, or a girl, equal to me. He's not trying to pull the wool over my eyes. He's not exaggerating his circumstances. He's trying to say, look, you know, I'm getting my stuff together. And what I think, more than anything, is we need people to connect with the big issue. We need people to buy the paper. Mm. We need people to take the paper. Because by taking the paper, you help them. Because if you say, oh, forget about it, here's the money, then you're turning them back into a beggar. So I might was well not have bothered. So it's a pity purchase you're turning into. I want you to buy that magazine, and I want you to read it. And I want you to enjoy it. And if you don't, you know, ring me up and I will, if you fill in about 7 different forms and, you know, and I will return 50% of your money. No, you know, I'm joking. But the point is, what is interesting is it's the collective involvement. But I also want you to wake up to your listenership or readership or whatever. I want them to wake up that we've got some pretty poor quality politics going on. We've got to get beyond the personality. We've got to get beyond all of the slagging off. Most people define themselves by the failures of others. And we've got to get beyond that, because that is very negative.
100%. Thank you so much for your time today. You've helped put things in perspective for me. For me, as I said, I'm always battling with this. You know, when I walk past someone who's homeless very often now, I will stop, I will talk if I've got the time. I find it important that they experience connection in the way that I do. But you've given me a better understanding of the issue, and I really appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Thank you. And I've enjoyed, as I always do, talking about one of the most incredibly exciting things about the big issue and the work that we do is that we can demonstrate you can bring social change in the lives of people who are abject and broken, and we can, you know, improve their lives and give them, you know, give them a good day. But at the same time, as I say, and I will say forever, we have to turn the tap off at the same time.
You've done it in a clever way. You've created a sense of community. Homeless people are very often these very isolated individuals that you see on the streets. And what you've done is you've created a community, a place of belonging, where they are able... We know that that's how we excel as human beings. That's why we are social creatures. We do better when we are together rather than when we're apart. And what you've done is you've created this space for lots of people to come together, and they, through that strength, they're growing. So commendable, amazing.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much for listening today, and thank you to Lord John Bird for a really enlightening conversation. I think really what I take from this conversation is the fact that our well-being isn't just supported by our friendships, but the broader social networks and just the compassion of the society we live in. I'd love to know your thoughts about today's conversation, so please do leave me some comments. Please like and subscribe to the podcast. And if there's anything that you're interested in, any topics to do with friendship which you think you'd like me to broach, reach out, let me know. Thank you.